Thanks, Ashley. I don't know if it sounds like my mom wrote that introduction. So I have nothing. Oh, can we hit the lights so that this is more visible? Is there a way to do that?
Martha. Thank you.
All right. Let there be darkness, and I will try to shed a light on the issue of GMOs. So I have nothing to declare. No one would ever sponsor my work. So that's just fine. Now, I have to say I bit off a little more than I could chew when I was first putting together this talk because I thought I would talk about biofarming also. But now that we don't have the third speaker, I will speak a little bit about biofarming. But I'm going to try to, in the next half hour, give you everything you want to know about genetically modified crops. We'll talk about what they are, how they're made, what they're intended to do, what corporate agribusiness will tell you that they do, what they don't do, and how this is really at heart a story of the corporate commodification of the world's food supply and the basically a way to perpetuate poverty and to increase corporate control over global agriculture. So GMOs are plants or even animals that are whose DNA has been altered through the addition of genes from other organisms. And this is at its most basic level done with a gene gun where the nucleus is blasted and the particular results of that you get the product that you want with the inserted gene in the correct place, and then you develop seeds from that and you sell those seeds. And before I go any further, I should actually mention also this slideshow is not on my website, but there are two slideshows on the website. It's publichealthandsocialjustice.org, phsj.org, or if you just Google public health and social justice, the first thing that comes up is my website, so you'll find it that way. And on there, there's a food safety and food justice page that has a slideshow that's about 100 slides looking at GMOs. And then there's a slideshow for the truly masochistic of about 400 slides that covers GMOs, biofarming, genetic modification of vertebrates, synthetic biology, including garage biology, which is people trying to reconstruct influenza viruses in their garage, getting help from colleagues on the internet, and so on. And all the slideshows on the website, including the other pages, which cover things like environmental health and women's rights and war and peace and so on, they are all entirely open access, meaning you can use all or part of the slideshow, just say where you got it, and they're updated every 6 months. So GMOs were first developed starting in 1982. They were first made commercially available in 1994. They are today grown commercially on over 420 million acres spread over 28 countries, accounting for 10% of global farmland. And in the U.S., half the total land that's used for crops is planted with genetically modified crops. Most of these crops are used for animal feed and biofuel production. These are the top GMO growing countries in the world. You can see U.S. is number one, followed by Brazil, Argentina, Canada, India, China, Paraguay, South Africa, Pakistan, and Uruguay. Some of our major crops are genetically modified to such a high degree that essentially almost all sugar beets, soybeans, canola, and cotton are genetically modified, and almost 90% of corn. Now, the purported purposes of GM crops when they first came into development were to do things like create plants that would have enhanced nutritional quality, maybe have an extra vitamin in them, be drought resistant, have a faster growth rate, enhanced ripening under suboptimal conditions, ways to prevent spoilage or change the appearance so that it was more palatable to a group that might want to eat something that looks a different way than another type of fruit, say, to alter its freezing properties so that it could grow in a different type of environment or that you could grow the crop year-round. But the actual characteristics of GM crops are such that about 80% of them are herbicide resistant, including 94% of soybeans, almost 80% of cotton. and about 20% produce their own pesticide. And the classic example of this is BT corn, which is corn that's modified with a gene from Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacterium, to produce their own insecticidal proteins, which are active against the corn borer, which is a major pest of corn crops. And basically, the EPA calls the corn itself a pesticide because the pesticide is part of the plant. 8%, so the numbers don't completely add up to 100, but some of these both produce their own pesticide and are herbicide resistant. And these foods, processed foods that are made from GM crops are ubiquitous. 85% of the processed foods available in the U.S. today come from GM crops. There has been increasing corporate control over agriculture worldwide. So if you go back to the mid-1970s, none of the 7,000 seed companies controlled over 0.5% of the global seed market. Today, just 10 corporations control 73% of global proprietary seed sales, and just 3 companies, Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, control a little over half of the world's seed supply. Many of the major ag biotech companies are also pharmaceutical companies, names that you'll recognize like Novartis, Aventis, Bayer Crop Science. And if you want to find out more about Bayer, I'm giving a talk in the 2:30 session here looking at the history of the Bayer Corporation, which is going to weave in stories of the Nazis and their involvement with the gas chambers and sponsoring Mengele's research, going through producing HIV-tainted blood to producing pesticides that are contributing to colony collapse disorder among bees and so on. And so it's a story of corporate malfeasance that will hopefully be interesting. BASF, Dow, and then the other two companies, Syngenta and DuPont Pioneer. These are the same companies that brought us things like Agent Orange, PCBs, dioxins, napalm, mustard gas, DDT, dioxins, PCBs, Durspan, ozone-destroying chlorofluorocarbons, agricultural antibiotics, a number of pharmaceuticals. And basically, these companies maintain a high degree of power in Washington through millions spent on lobbying and campaign donations. They also sponsor professorships at many institutions and, in fact, sometimes sponsor entire departments. And since much of the research that's done with corporate money is considered proprietary, could lead, for instance, if you're a PhD candidate doing research on a particular type of GM seed and you find something that is antithetical to the corporate message, they might say, we're sorry you can't publish your PhD thesis, thereby putting off you getting your degree for years. They also freely distribute to cash-strapped public school districts sponsored curricula that sing the praises of corporate and global or corporate and agricultural bioethics, including the production of GM crops. GM regulation in this country is weak and rather diffuse, and it's divided between 3 agencies. The USDA covers field testing, the EPA deals with environmental concerns, and the EPA only requires short-term animal testing of 30 to 90 days, which is how long most industry studies last, and certainly does not mimic what humans would have over the course of many years of eating GM crops. Industry then selects which data to submit to the EPA. And then the FDA has come out and said that GE crops are essentially equivalent to non-GE foods. There's no requirement at all for human safety testing. And the writing of this FDA policy was overseen by Michael Taylor, who was a Monsanto attorney just before going to the FDA and was rewarded for this policy when he left the FDA and became a Monsanto vice president. Now, at least in terms of the USDA, the Office of the Inspector General back in 2006 says that the department has failed to regulate trials of GE crops adequately, and we'll see why that is in a moment. Now, I was very involved in the ballot initiative, Measure 92 in Oregon, to require that genetically modified processed foods sold in supermarkets be labeled. This was the same as a ballot measure that we had back in 2002. And in 2002, we were outspent $6 million to $200,000. Most of that $200,000 came from just a few large donors and a number of very small donations distributed throughout the state, and almost all of the $6 million came from corporate agribusiness headquartered outside of the state of Oregon. And at that time, as today, 90 to 95% of people in public opinion polls favor the labeling of genetically modified foodstuffs. And yet we were hammered in that election, 70% no to 30% in favor of labeling, because there was the promulgation of such a large degree of misinformation and outright lies. People were scared off by costs of up to $1,500 per family to do the labeling. They were told that this would interfere with church bake sales and other places of kids selling lemonade and brownies on street corners and so on, and it was all completely untrue, but it scared off the voters. And so this time around, we thought we had a good chance. There was a ballot measure in California, which barely lost, another in Washington, where it was 51 to 49%. And I regret to say that it looks like we're going to lose this one. It's 50-50, and they're still counting ballots, but the odds of us still taking the measure, which would have to go to a recount, are about 5%, perhaps. And we were outspent this time by 19 million to, I'm sorry, 24 million to 9 million. Almost all, again, of that $24 million in spending came from outside of the state of Oregon, from corporations. Of the 9 million that we had, there was a million from the Center for Food Safety. There was a large amount from David Bronner of Bronner's Soaps. But we had something like 30,000 individual donations to our campaign, so it certainly had broad public appeal and support. These were anything from $5 to $100. The no on labeling side had something like less than 10, at last count that I heard, of private citizens who had donated to their campaign. So why label genetically modified crops? Well, we already label foods in the U.S. for their vitamin, mineral, calorie, and fat content. We label them for sulfite so that people who have allergies can avoid those foods. For the source of protein so that vegetarians can avoid meat proteins. We label foods to be kosher or halal, not from concentrate. Having recycled contents, being wild, being union made, made in the U.S. for some foods, country of origin labeling. The one food label I would advise you to avoid and not have put any faith in is natural. Natural is a meaningless term, and I'm sure you all know that. So worldwide, there are 64 countries that label. In fact, many European countries have outright banned genetically modified crops. And in fact, when the United Kingdom rolled out its labeling law, Monsanto supported it in ads and in editorials in the newspaper. And a former VP for the Federal Affairs Division of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is the trade group that encompasses supermarkets and liquor stores and whatnot, he said adding a few words to a label has no impact on the price or making or selling food. So basically, this would cost them nothing. Labeling did not increase the cost of food in any of the other countries with labeling laws. Consumers Union has said that there would be no increased costs expected with labeling. And labels are changed often. Think how often you see new and improved on a food item. So there has been successful legislation at the state level to require labeling. Unfortunately, these laws require that a certain number of other adjacent states adopt labeling laws within a certain period of time, or else they won't take effect. And then all these ballot measures, the Colorado ballot measure was solidly beaten, something like 70 to 30. So why would we label genetically engineered foods? Well, I'm going to talk about the health and environmental consequences in a bit, but the first thing we would want to do is to prevent anyone from having an allergic reaction. Now, years ago, there were soybeans that were modified with Brazil nut genes. This was noted pre-marketing, and so these never were sold in supermarkets or commercialized, but you can imagine if someone had a Brazil nut allergy and ate a soybean, not expecting to have potentially anaphylaxis from it. That could be a major public health problem. Labeling would allow vegetarians to avoid animal genes, such as tomatoes that are produced with genes from flounder. This is the Flavor Saver tomato, which was test marketed but never had any public traction, and to heighten public awareness of genetic engineering, because only 1 in 4 Americans believe they have eaten GM foods, whereas we all have and all do on essentially a daily basis. So in some sense, the spread, the literal explosion of GM foods on the market has been the largest uncontrolled, unconsented clinical trial in the history of humanity, because all of us have an alimentary tract and all of us are eating genetically modified foods with minimal pre-market, minimal to no pre-market safety testing. Labeling would also grant people the freedom to choose what they eat based on their individual willingness to confront risk and ensure a healthy debate over the merits of genetic modification. So what are these health risks? There have been a number of human and animal studies. The human studies have been hard to do, in part because the seeds have only been made available to independent, and I put that in air quotes because many of them still aren't, to independent researchers since 2010. And so conducting a longitudinal feeding study that involves humans is very difficult to do, especially since most of us are already eating GM crops. But you could do it from one country to another. And in fact, just this week they announced an international consortium based in Moscow that's going to conduct a 2-year feeding study that is going to look at this. Now that's going to involve animals, but they're looking at a phase 2 trial that will involve humans. So there have been animal studies done. As I said earlier, the animal studies that are done by industry tend to last 30 to 60 days. There was a 2-year study done by a researcher named Cirillini that found a number of adverse consequences on effects of feeding GM crops, including tumors, changes in the types of immune cells, and an increase in inflammatory mediators, impairment of fertility, increased miscarriages, increased allergies, premature death. And there have been a number of shorter animal studies that have shown the same thing. And there have also been studies looking, for instance, at shipyard workers that are offloading genetically modified rice versus non-genetically modified rice and their rates of allergies and asthma and so on, and found an effect. So Cirillini was absolutely vilified. His paper ended up being withdrawn by the journal editors. They then hired a person who was a supposed independent editor to look at the paper again, who in fact had multiple industry contacts, and there was a resounding support for him because the paper was found to be solid by numerous international investigators. It ultimately got republished in a different journal, but if you want to read the whole story of that, it's in the long slideshow on the website. So the concept with, say, herbicide-resistant genetically modified crops is you make your soybeans resistant to, say, Roundup, which is glyphosate, which is a Monsanto herbicide. And then what you do is you plant your genetically modified soybeans and you just spray the entire field with glyphosate. And it kills every weed, every other plant that's there, and the soybeans grow. But anyone who understands evolution will recognize that over time, those weeds can become resistant to glyphosate and invade. And then you have to have another herbicide that you can spray on the plant. So then what you get are stacked products. So soybeans that are modified to resist glyphosate and a second herbicide. So now you have to spray 2 different herbicides. And they're at the point now where they're up to 6 stacked herbicides in some products that are in the experimental stage and coming to market soon, again, because of this increasing development of resistance among weeds. And so what happened early on is that when GM crops were first introduced, for the first few years there was a decrease in overall herbicide use because it simplified the use of herbicide by farmers. They didn't have to use as much, they just sprayed once with the glyphosate and things were done. But then, as resistance developed and you had stacked products that were resistant to multiple herbicides, herbicide use went up dramatically. So we're looking at 500 million tons of herbicide between 1996 and 2014. Insecticide use for the BT corn, for instance, same thing happened, although insecticide resistance took much longer to occur. So it's really been over the last few years that insecticide use has gone up as insects like the corn borer have become resistant and are able to attack and eat the BT corn, and then farmers have had to use increasing amounts and increasing numbers of different insecticides. Now, greater herbicide use can lead to fungal root infections, and thus, in turn, increase the need to use insecticides because bugs tend to seek out sicker plants. Herbicides are also harmful to monarch butterflies, and we've seen an 81% decline in the population of these butterflies. This is primarily due to glyphosate damage to milkweed plants in the Midwest of the U.S., which is where the monarchs lay their eggs. And we've also seen, as I said, greater insecticide use. So there have been studies looking at the amount of glyphosate residues in diets in humans and animals, and those diets that have higher residues of this pesticide, and residues stay on the plants. For every American, we spray anywhere between 6 and 8 pounds of pesticide per person per year in the United States on our crops, and some of this stays on the plants. We also import a number of items that are heavily pesticide-laden products, such as cut flowers, many of which are grown under conditions where they're using pesticides that are outlawed in the United States. And those flowers are then imported to the U.S., and it's great because little kids like to eat those flowers, and they get exposed to these incredibly dangerous, I should say great, I'm being facetious, exposed to these pesticides. So high glyphosate residues in diet are linked to a number of health consequences: sterility, miscarriage, birth defects, endocrine disruption, liver and kidney disease, neurologic disease including Alzheimer's, non-Hodgkin's, lymphoma, hairy cell leukemia, multiple myeloma, breast and brain cancer, and alterations in the microbiome. Those are the bacteria that live on and in you. And the EU has bought into this evidence because they're outlawing glyphosate come 2016. The increased use of pesticides, and in this slide by pesticides I mean herbicides and insecticides, is important because farm workers have been estimated by the EPA to suffer 300,000 pesticide-related acute illnesses and injuries per year. There's 1 million people that have been killed by pesticides over the last 6 years, according to the WHO, and pesticides in our food could cause up to 1 million cancers in the current generation of Americans, according to the National Academy of Sciences. Pesticides have been linked to autism, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, diabetes, obesity, depression, ADHD. And so we have a lot of potential health consequences and real health consequences. Now, what are the environmental risks of GE crops? One would be that genes initially designed to protect crops from herbicides could be transferred to native weeds. This would result in the creation of so-called super weeds. This also just occurs when weeds themselves become resistant to the herbicide, and these super weeds can take over not only that farmer's crop but adjacent crops. GE crops can also contaminate nearby fields and can contaminate the food supply in very significant ways. So there have been about 400 events that were documented between 1996 and 2013, 50% involved GE crops originating in the U.S. So the real number is probably greater if you look at worldwide. The affected countries from these contamination events have been double the number of countries where GM crops are actually grown, meaning that these seeds are really spreading on the wind. So, for instance, that would account for native Mexican corn varieties in the highlands of Mexico being found to be contaminated by U.S.-grown genetically modified corn. Some of the major events that you may have heard about were the Starlink incident back in 2000, where unapproved GM corn contaminated the food supply, leading to $1 billion in food recalls. In 2002, there was some GM corn that was engineered to produce a pig vaccine, and it contaminated soybeans throughout Nebraska and Iowa. Bayer Crop Science produced a product called Liberty Link, herbicide-tolerant rice, which contaminated the food supply in 2006. Bayer kept the contamination secret for 6 months. The consequence of this were the closing of European and other markets to U.S. rice, which had a dramatic impact on the economy of the U.S. Southeast and cost over $1 billion already just in court settlements. And just last year, GE wheat was found in Oregon, where it hadn't been grown for well over a decade. This led to the suspension of imports from Oregon wheat to Japan and Korea, and the long-term impacts of this on my state's economy are potentially quite severe because our wheat crop is valued at approximately $400 million. In terms of the economics of GE crops, recent studies have cast doubt even on their economic utility. They were initially sold by corporate agribusiness as being cheaper for farmers. You get all your seeds in one place, you just use one herbicide, it's cheaper than using traditional agriculture. But in fact, what we found is lower yields in GM crops and higher input costs, higher seed costs because the manufacturers up the price. And in fact, non-GE plant breeding and farming methods have increased yields of major grain crops from 13 to 25% depending on the crop. Am I doing okay? I can continue to ramble on? Okay. The planting of GE crops has effects on organic farmers. There's over 17,000 of these in the United States, and the cost to prevent GM contamination and pesticide drift are anywhere from $7,000 to $30,000 per organic farmer per year because they have to plant buffer zones and they have to delay their planting so it's not occurring at the same time as a neighboring field with GE crops. And if their crops do get contaminated, it can have, of course, tremendous financial consequences because they'll lose their label as organic and they'll lose markets. What about more environmental risks? Well, GE crops could outcompete or even drive to extinction, potentially wild varieties, or become bioinvaders in neighboring farms and other ecosystems. GE plants are known to adversely affect soil bacteria and consequently soil quality. And a major concern is the further decrease in agricultural biodiversity. So the Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that 75% of the genetic diversity in agriculture that was present at the beginning of the 20th century has already been lost. And there's unknown effects on the integrity of the global food supply from large-scale genetic rearrangements. With corporate control of the seed supply, the current contracts require farmers to buy new seeds annually. There have been multiple lawsuits brought by a coven of Monsanto and other attorneys that basically go around looking for contamination and then sue the farmers whose field might have been contaminated because a passing truck had some seeds that blew off of it that implanted in that farmer's field. And then this is the thing that really scares me is there's something called terminator seeds. And these seeds are actually sterile. They can't be cropped and re-sown. So they still produce pollen. So the potential risk is that their genes that make them sterile could make non-GM crops sterile as well. And if you really want to get apocalyptic, this could lead to the devastation of the entire planet's corn supply, for instance, or soybean supply, making us have to go back to the seed bank up in Norway and find the original varieties and undergo a replanting experiment. So there is a de facto moratorium on terminator seeds under the UN Convention on Biological Diversity. The U.S. is trying to overturn this, though. Now I want to talk a little bit about how corporations have tried to sell seeds in open markets to genetically engineered foods and how they've done it in what I think is a really underhanded and vile way. So back in the early 2000s, there was a famine in Zambia, and the countries where these corporations are based and the corporations themselves attempted through the Food and Agriculture Organization and through the WHO to use that famine as a way to market GE foods through aid programs. In other words, they said, we will give you food aid and seed aid, but it has to be GE seeds. Now, fortunately, more than 40 other countries expressed a willingness to supply local non-genetic modified food aid. So why would Zambia not want GE foods and GE seeds? Well, they didn't want to pollute their own crops with GE foods because that could have devastated their export economy because many of the crops grown there are exported to countries in Europe and elsewhere that don't accept GE imports. And so 70% of employment, if you look at all of sub-Saharan Africa, and 35% of GNP in sub-Saharan Africa is agriculture-based, and much of this is based on them growing non-GM crops that they can sell to markets that will only accept non-GM crops. So if you play things out over the next decade or so, there were similar events with famines in Zimbabwe, Malawi, Angola, where companies tried to do basically the same thing. Now, GE foods have been promoted as the solution to world hunger. However, no commercially available GE crop exists that's drought-resistant, salt-resistant, flood-tolerant, or that increases yields. The USDA has admitted as much. So indeed, what they do is they undermine food and nutritional security, food sovereignty, and food democracy. And if GE crops were really designed to eliminate world hunger, they would do things such as be able to grow on substandard or marginal soils, to produce more high-quality protein with increased yields per acre, without the need for expensive machinery, chemicals, fertilizers, or water. If they were designed to eliminate world hunger, they'd be engineered to favor small farms over larger farms, they'd be cheap and freely available without restrictive licensing, and they'd be designed for crops that feed people, not crops that are used for biofuels and to feed livestock. So I would argue that our increasing reliance on GE food consolidates corporate control of agriculture because these crops are supplied mainly by just a handful of companies, and indeed they transmogrify farmers into bioserfs. There is already more than enough food to feed the planet. Feeding everyone requires not genetic engineering or really complicated laboratory science. It simply requires political and social will. Half of American food goes to waste, and just 1 week of developed world farm subsidies is equal to the annual cost of food aid to entirely eliminate world hunger. 1 week of developed world farm subsidies. And some major bodies have recognized this. So the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights has in fact said that poverty is exacerbated by GM seeds. Its International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development stated that same year that GE crops are unlikely to achieve the goal of feeding a hungry world. So what are the solutions? Labeling initiatives are just one start, and legislation too. Exposing and opposing industry attempts to preempt labeling initiatives. So some states, legislatures, they've tried to pass laws that say no county within this state can pass a GM labeling bill, or the state itself cannot pass a GM labeling bill. These are somewhat similar to the ag gag laws that you might be familiar with. And then, of course, one solution is to outlaw GM crops. Some places have. Marin County, Mendocino County, Jackson and Josephine counties in Oregon, and other places, and certainly many other countries in the world. As individuals, we should support local organic agriculture and patronize farmers' markets. Why? Organic farming produces higher yields than non-organic farming, uses less energy, less water, no pesticides, and organic foods contain up to 20% higher concentration of minerals and vitamins, 30% more antioxidants, lower level of toxic metals, cadmium, lead, mercury, and so on. And we should support independent research on GM crops. It's only been the last 4 years that the seeds have been somewhat made available. And even then, sponsored researchers have to sign confidentiality agreements. And we should also support increased research and subsidies for traditional organic agriculture. We need to support equitable distribution of agricultural resources among populations worldwide and increased non-GM agricultural aid to developing nations. Everyone thinks that the U.S. is a very generous donor on the global scene. If you ask, and they have, public surveys, what percentage of U.S. GDP goes to foreign aid, what do you think people say? ~25% What is it really? Does anyone know?
2.3
It's about 1%. And if you divide that up, much of that is aid that simply goes to a foreign country where it's received by an American corporation that's building a dam or building a chemical plant or something else, and the money goes right back to the shareholders. It's actually a tiny amount that goes to things like healthcare, education, alleviation of poverty. And while in absolute numbers, we lead the world in international aid. If you look at international aid as a percentage of gross domestic product, we're 21st in the world. So we're not as generous as we like to think we are. So where can you find these references? There are numerous peer-reviewed articles. The best compendium I'll come to in a minute, but you can go on the Union of Concerned Scientists website, Consumers Union, Center for Food Safety, GM Watch. They have a listserv where they'll send you one email a month with the latest on GM research. Earth Open Source, its publication, GMO Myths and Truths, is very well documented. It's got over 400 peer-reviewed citations that back up all of what I'm saying here. Food and Water Watch, you can find it also. And then you can find it on my website. And again, that's all open access. So do you want to leave questions for the very end? Or?
We'll leave it at the end.
Okay, yeah. So I hope I was that about right?
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect. Good. Wow. Thank you.